Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, a recap of Magic Jackson's stop at the WISO studios for a live performance on Kaleidoscope. Deborah Schultz is the co-founder of the annual MidFest International. We'll talk to her about what's taking place this year. And Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio, all that and more. Up first, the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy ended last Tuesday. The policy was aimed at prohibiting military personnel from discriminating against or harassing homosexual or bisexual service members, but it also barred openly gay, lesbian, or bisexual individuals from entering military service. John Snoddy is a civilian workforce liaison at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. As a civil servant, Snoddy wasn't affected by the policy, but he spent 13 years in active duty service and another 3 years in the reserves. His military service ended in 2006. Don't Ask, Don't Tell was enacted soon after John Snoddy began his military service.
Whenever I first started the military, I mean, I was a kid, 22 years old, so I wasn't really sure who I was at that time. And it was after I joined the military that I finally realized that, yeah, I need to accept my gayness and that it's a part of me and I'm not going to deny it.
So let's talk about Don't Ask, Don't Tell as a policy. And are there instances that you can describe for us that you witnessed with some of your fellow military servicemen and women?
Well, certainly with security clearances, they used to ask, are you gay? They would patrol gay bars. And at that time, we had stickers on bumpers that identified cars as DOD. And they would take your sticker number and they would call you in. Office of Special Investigations, OSI, agents would call you in and question you and say, hey, your car was outside of a gay bar in the parking lot. And so it was a cat and mouse type game. And so you just tried to stay below the radar.
So in some instances, you could just say, I was there with friends. I am not gay. And you could portray yourself or continue to try and portray yourself as someone you were not.
Unfortunately, that was part of the program. If you wanted to keep your security clearance, if you wanted to keep your job, you either had to out and out deny it or remain silent and protest in silence. There's no way that you could actively say, yes, I'm gay.
What does that do to you in the way that you feel about your service to the country and the way you feel about how you're leading your personal life when there's that conflict?
It's an ambivalent feeling. You realize that you're doing something important because you are protecting and defending the Constitution of the United States. I don't think that there's any higher calling, any higher service than to do that. Conversely, the reality is that you're supporting an organization that doesn't support you personally. So it's very difficult. And you just have to get through those particular instances day by day.
It's been pointed out this week that with a policy like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, plenty of people were punished for either telling or being told on, but nobody was ever punished during that policy for asking.
That's the double-edged sword, is that if you had somebody disgruntled, particularly a disgruntled lover, that they could turn up the heat on you and you could potentially lose your job, lose your security clearance just because somebody, some anonymous somebody, reported you as potentially being gay.
I know the military has done extensive training for servicemen and women on how to deal with this going forward, but what are your hopes for the future and for the military?
These views are strictly my own and do not represent the official views of the United States Air Force in any way, shape, or form. But certainly I'm hoping for parity across the board. I hope that this is just the first step. I know that the military hasn't come to terms with, are they going to perform gay marriages or gay unions. With the Defense of Marriage Act, We need to make sure that federal discrimination is eliminated across the board and that we repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. So we've got a lot of work to do. This is the first step.
John Snoddy, Workforce Management Liaison with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Thanks for speaking with us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
I never seen you looking so bad, my funky one. You tell me that your super fine mind has come undone. Any major dude with half a heart surely will tell you, my friend. Any minor world that breaks apart falls together again. When the demon is at your door, in the morning it won't be there no more. Any major dude will tell you. Any major dude will tell you. Seen a squawk's tears? Well, look at mine. The people on the street have all seen better times. Any major dude with half a heart surely will tell you, my friend. Any minor world that breaks apart falls together again. When the demon is at your door, in the morning it won't be there. No.
MidFest International is an annual event that looks in depth at different countries each year, and they bring those countries right here to the Miami Valley. Deborah Schultz is the co-founder of MidFest International. This year, she's directing the Economic Development Program and the World Heritage and Archaeology Project. She joins us by phone this morning to talk about some of the activities surrounding this year's event. Deb, nice to speak with you.
Nice to speak with you.
So tell us a little bit about MidFest International for our folks who may not have heard of it.
Well, for 30 years, MidFest International, based in Middletown, Ohio, has been taking a look at a different country each year in depth and trying to tell the stories of those countries through the lens of the arts and humanities, trade and investment, journalism, performance, sports, food, as many ways as we can think of to bring out the essence of those countries that we take a look at.
MidFest International actually takes place next weekend, but starting today you've got some events taking place.
Yes, we have the opening of our exhibit from the National Geographic Society in Washington, D.C. It's called Machu Picchu, A Lost City Uncovered, The Expeditions of Hiram Bingham, 1911 to 1915, and it's a series of black and white photos of his rediscovery of Machu Picchu back in 1911. It's very exciting because we're the first city to have this exhibition outside of Washington, D.C. and National Geographic Society there.
What were some of the challenges, if any, of bringing this exhibit to Middletown?
Well, we literally picked up a number of exhibits from the Peruvian Embassy, which cooperated with National Geographic to get us this wonderful exhibit. We brought another exhibit called the Señora de Cal, which is a replica of a very important find of a woman who they believe was the one and only woman ruler. Some believe that one and only woman ruler in Peru that they have found in an archaeological excavation of the Moche culture. So we were able to bring that, and that's a rather large statue of a tattooed woman, And so we rented a truck, and we brought that back, and we brought a wonderful potato exhibit back that the embassy lent us, and then we brought the crates back from the National Geographic. So in the sense of a challenge, it was just challenging actually to get it here.
So let's talk about the actual festival of sorts, MidFest International, that takes place next weekend.
Well, we like to think of ourselves as very unique or atypical, so we don't typically call ourselves festival. We call celebration because we're both educational and entertaining, and we probably are one of the few, events like this in the country, at least according to one of our guests last year, who is the Botswana ambassador, who spent the whole weekend with us and said he thought that MidFest was unique in the country. But we have everything. We have wonderful performances this year. We have several from Peru, a group called Inca Son that is a music and dance ensemble that will work over the weekend. We have Christian Navarro, who comes directly from Peru for us. He's an Afro-Peruvian acrobatic dancer. We have the Edward Perez Peruvian Jazz Ensemble. But we also have some performances from the Southwest Ohio Symphonic Band, the Thai culture and fine art performers out of Chicago, and an Indonesian group, and many more things that I can't talk about in terms of performance because I don't want to spoil the surprise. But we have this wonderful project that I've been directing this year. It's this wonderful archaeology project. Would you like to hear about that?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, the Ohio Humanities Council, which is a state arm of the National Endowment for the Humanities, has worked with MidFest over the years to bring together projects in history, religion, political science. And this year, they've given us a major grant to do a project called The Art of Preservation, World Heritage Sites, and the Archaeological Treasures of Peru. This started in the spring. We brought in a wonderful professor from Yale who spoke at the Cincinnati Art Museum about the return of the Machu Picchu artifacts. This year marks, by the way, the 100th anniversary of Bingham's discovery of Machu Picchu, so it's a great year to be looking at the country of Peru. So we started with that lecture. We gave one from the National Park Service, which, believe it or not, works with UNESCO World Heritage in establishing World Heritage Sites and was actually an early progenitor of ideas that worked out to be this World Convention on World Heritage that UNESCO administers for all the countries of the world, so that they have all these sites, both natural and historical sites, throughout the world that are to be shared and by all humanity. So he came, and then we have someone from Ohio talk about World Heritage in Ohio. She is the superintendent of the Hopewell Cultural National Historical Park in Chillicothe, and she talked about Ohio's aspirations for World Heritage sites, one being the Hopewell culture itself, and perhaps even aviation, and the whole process you go through to become a World Heritage Site, which is quite lengthy. So at MidFest itself, we'll be focusing more on Peru. Peru has 11 World Heritage Sites. We're going to have four distinguished archaeologists talking about Incas, talking about Paracas, Nazcas, some of the other important archaeological sites in Peru. And then we're going to have a couple of our people coming in who are experts on how to preserve these sites. What are the things that have to happen in order for this wonderful World Heritage to be literally preserved? I don't know if you know or not, but there's 2,500 people a day that go to Machu Picchu. And because it is such a popular site, that means there's a lot of wear and tear on the site. So you have to work with local populations to make sure that they buy into protecting these sites, as well as set up safeguards so that the popularity of a site does not become a detriment to it. So those are just a couple of the things that we're going to be talking about in what we're calling our Archaeology Center, which will have speakers all weekend long at simultaneously when we're having performances and conversations with our diplomatic corps that's coming in, and lots of other things to do at MidFest.
Deborah, it sounds like there is a huge opportunity for adults and youth in the area to come to MidFest and get a little education. MidFest International Weekend, September 30th through October 2nd. After that weekend, do you get a break or do you jump right in and start planning next year's event?
It actually takes about 3 months after the event to sort of wind up everything that happens during the weekend. As I said, we work from the embassy level on down to immigrant groups in our region. And so there are a lot of people involved. There are lots of committees, lots of volunteers. One of the things that we do in November is we have something called the MIRA Awards, which is the MidFest International Recognition Award. We've been doing that pretty much from the beginning or 30 years ago to recognize those volunteers who have made outstanding contributions to MidFest International and some of our partners. So that takes place, and that takes a lot of planning. And then there's just a lot of cleanup in terms of sending exhibits back, making sure all our performers and scholars and diplomats and everyone who comes in gets safely back home with all of their belongings. So it takes about 3 months, and then in January the process begins again for another country. So I like to say we're very entrepreneurial. We're very lean staffed with a lot of volunteer help, that are a lot of talented volunteers that have been with us for a very long time. And we really work hard to make this happen. It's an abundance of riches within a very short period of time.
MidFest International, a lot of events coming up next weekend. All the information is at midfestinternational.org.
Also on Facebook, just type in MidFest International and join the growing number of people that are liking us on Facebook.
Deborah Schultz, co-founder of MidFest International, thanks so much for speaking with us this morning.
It's been my great pleasure. Come to MidFest.
I got no feeling left, no heartbeat in my chest. You shut my body down when you started messing around. You got me paranoid, I think I hear your voice. It had me freaking out when you started messing around. Got me paralyzed from all your funkin' lies. You kick me when I'm down when you started messing around. You can't erase me, try to replace me. I barely left your town when you started messing around.
On Wednesday, Magic Jackson stopped by the WYSO studios for a live performance on Kaleidoscope. The band talked with host Juliet Fromholt about their roots in Dayton music and what it's been like performing together.
You guys obviously are really, really in tune with one another as you're playing, and I would think you would have to be to do those long stretches, going, you know, blending song into song and doing those long jams. How long did it take for that to really click as a foursome?
Well, actually, this lineup's only been together for probably 6 months or so.
Wow.
But I think it just kind of speaks to the ability of everybody playing the group, that it's like, here's a ton of songs, let's learn them and get it together. And, I mean, John was kind of the last piece of this puzzle as we currently are, and we've literally dropped probably 20 songs on them. And see, for us, we're still working on stuff, you know what I mean? It's like, we're, for however you hear it, it's like we're hearing other things, and we kind of see where the direction of things are going, and kind of a point right now where we've got like a solid hour and a half to 2 hours just nailed down.
Have your songs evolved throughout, you know, different lineup changes and things like that, and even from show to show? Are they always, you know, are there elements that always stay the same and things that change, or is it always changing and evolving?
I think as you're traveling down the road, you see the same signposts, but you notice different things along the way, and I think that's kind of how we are, is that each song has certain signposts, whether energy-wise or, you know, sometimes like emotionally, or when you're just feeling the thing, everybody knows it's time to move on and start looking for the next signpost. But along the way, you notice this here or that there, and there's room to explore within those gaps, you know. But I think essentially we're all kind of looking for the same things along the way to know where we're at, you know.
I take a kind of a Zen philosophy towards it that every time I play the song, it's the first time I've ever played it. So there's always those elements of surprise or something new, regardless of how many times you've ever played the song. So, but I think, too, also some of us come from a heavily improvised background of playing a lot of improvised music, which also helps for any of those kind of curveballs that I think will happen.
Well, let's talk about background a little bit. You know, just in hearing what you were playing, I heard rock and roll, I heard jam, I heard jazz, like straight up, like traditional jazz, and then a lot of funk in there too. Where do you guys come from musically, and how do you bring that into what you're playing?
Well, when I first started playing music, I played a lot of punk rock and speed metal.
Nice.
Believe it or not. And I think that's kind of where I try to bring the energy from. But I've pretty much played every style of music in almost every genre that I've ever heard at some point. But I love that. I love something about all music. So I think that, but you know, I got heavily into my mother's jazz and funk and soul records. At the same time, I'm listening to all my dad's Johnny Cash and Buddy Holly and all the doo-wop bands and stuff like that. And at the same time as that's happening, I have all my older cousins feeding me full of Frank Zappa, Parliament and Funkadelic, and James Brown, and just all those great bands from the 70s. And so, you know, I try to in some way encapsulate something from all those styles, and because I love something about all of them.
I'd say that, I mean, how you describe things pretty much nails it on the head. I mean, you picked up on everything that's kind of in there.
Right.
I think we all have each one of those things that you mentioned within what we gravitate towards. But I'm sure that we've all just kind of discovered each thing at a different point. And, you know, for me, I grew up listening to Motown stuff and you know, Stax Records and all the stuff that... the R&B, classic R&B.
Well, that's
you know?
Where it's at. That's where it's
yeah.
at.
Yeah. Well, and for me as a rhythm player, that's totally where it's at, is the Steve Cropper style guy in the corner that's totally locked in with the bass and with the drums, you know? But I think, I don't know. Like right now, I think we're a solid Dayton band. It kind of epitomized what Dayton is about. I don't know. I mean, everybody, there's so many opinions on what Dayton's about, I guess, but... For us, all the funk that I really dug the most after kind of digging through, I realized that's from Dayton, you know? There's like the hard rock thing, and then you go back before that, and there's the Slave and Ohio Players and Fazo, and, you know, that's the stuff that we've really been listening to a ton, at least I've been listening to it. I know Mike has too, but I love James Brown, and I think the best band right now for the money is Jamiroquai. You know, I would travel anywhere to see those guys if they... would come to this country, you know?
Well, I think we're fortunate being from Ohio with that encapsulated. Anywhere I've ever been, people are like, oh, you're from Ohio, you know, King Records, you mm-hmm. know, stuff like that, where it's like, this is the nucleus of where yeah. all that funk style of music, regardless of if you play jazz, all the jazz cats I know that are from Ohio, they have this certain kind of funkiness with them that you don't get from the cats from New York or from Chicago yeah. or even from New Orleans. That's a different funk down there. But, you know, there's something specific about this region with that, and I think it's very fortunate to kind of be, you know, part of that.
You got me paralyzed from all your funkin' lies. You kicked me when I'm down, when you started messing around. You can't erase me, try to replace me. I barely left your town when you started messing around.
Magic Jackson performing live on Kaleidoscope. You can catch them performing at Canal Street Tavern on October 1st with Romeo Champagne. To hear their full interview, visit our website, wyso.org.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord, and today I'm speaking with Jo Ingles. She's a reporter with the State House News Bureau. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Lawmakers passed the congressional redistricting map proposed by Republicans this week. Does it look pretty much the same, or have there been some changes?
Well, there weren't really any changes to the map, per se. But what did change was the way that it's implemented. We saw an amendment put in the Senate that basically added money to the map, $2.4 million. That goes to the boards of elections throughout the state to help them administer the upcoming elections. It also will help them with these deadlines that they have to deal with that could be quite frankly hard to deal with because they're coming so quickly. December is a filing deadline that they have to deal with. And also they've got these petition signatures that they're trying to certify because the recently passed election reform law, the Democrats and opponents of that have been collecting signatures to put that on the ballot in 2012. Now, if they're able to do that, it will; those rules will not be in place for this November and next November until Ohioans vote on it.
So at this point, then, if there's money involved in this bill, is there any recourse for Democrats on this map?
Well, it'll be hard to do a referendum. I'm being told there's like a sliver of a chance that they could do that if they wanted to because of the way one of the decisions by the court was construed. But that will be harder to do. But they can take it to court, and they are looking at their legal options. And I would not be surprised at all if this lands up in court because, after all, it usually does somehow.
Democrats have proposed their own version of the map this week. What did it look like? And any chance that their ideas will be incorporated?
Well, no, because the congressional map has already passed. So that's water under the bridge. But they did put forth a map in the Senate. It was basically one of the maps that had come about through this contest that a bunch of groups, citizens groups, had held a contest on redistricting and allowed people to submit their ideas and draw their own maps. And one of those maps was actually submitted. That didn't get much consideration. So they say, well, those maps really weren't consistent. They didn't take into account the Voting Rights Act, that the numbers of population were off, Republican Keith Faber said, you know, they just weren't constitutional. So they went ahead with the map that they've had, and the congressional map has been pretty much decided, waiting on Governor John Kasich's signature. But after that happens, that map is pretty much decided. What we do have is the legislative maps have just now come out, and it looks like those maps have some of the same issues that Democrats were concerned about in that congressional redistricting map. The maps are not pretty. Some of the counties appear to be broken up a little bit. And it looks like, I'm just guessing from at this point, that the Democrats are not going to like these legislative maps any better than they did the congressional maps.
Now, in Dayton this week, the local chapter of the NAACP came out in opposition to the map, and they recited concerns that it might violate the federal law by splitting the black vote in Montgomery County. And I'm wondering, in Columbus, what's the reaction from black lawmakers?
Well, you know, by and large, the black lawmakers were the ones who actually liked these maps, the various versions that we've seen. They liked the map that was proposed, the congressional map that actually passed. They liked that map specifically because it treated minority districts in a way that they liked. And we even saw some of the African-American lawmakers voting for the map in the end because of the way it treated minority districts. Now, we did see some of the African-American lawmakers stand up and say that they thought that these maps, even though they were kind to minority districts in general, that kindness came at the expense of Democratic voters. And Senator Shirley Smith was one of the folks who stood up on the floor of the legislature and said, you know, we have a problem here because while it's good for minorities, it's not good for Democrats. It's not fair. These maps have the congressional map that passed has four Democratic-leaning districts, but it has 12 Republican-leaning districts. And, you know, the Democrats and the opponents of this map say this is a 50-50 state, that it can go Republican or Democrat, and that the map should reflect that.
I've been speaking with Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield. Before we go, here's Sarah Buckingham with a look at tonight's Sunday Documentary Hour.
Last week, we heard the first episode of a new three-part series called Tomorrow's College. The second part of this American Radio Works series on higher education airs tonight. Producer Emily Hanford looks at how research on the ways in which people learn changes institutions of higher education, or sometimes doesn't. In the past 30 years, scientists have discovered a lot about how people learn, but traditional universities are slow to change their ways. Lecturing was invented as a way to share information in a time before books were widely available. Now there are better approaches. Tonight's documentary tells the story of how some physics professors figured out the lecture wasn't working, and how a group of educators in Minnesota are inventing a new kind of college. Don't Lecture Me, produced by Emily Hanford, tonight at 6 and 11 p.m. on the Sunday Documentary Hour.
Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.